Hi, this is Bill Radke, and you're listening to Weekend America's MP3 podcast, and there's nothing wrong with that. But did you know there's a way to hear all of Weekend America, plus see pictures, videos, skip forward and backward through stories with better sound quality? It's the Weekend America Enhanced Podcast. And to subscribe, search for Weekend America in iTunes or go to our website and click on Enhanced Podcast.
Coming up on Weekend America.
After fighting in Iraq, soldiers rush home.
Things had wrapped up. We went to King Fahad Air Base, got on a plane with stewardesses and everything. We were full of sand and armed.
But later we'll ask if they should take their time. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. If you had to leave your home, what's the one thing you'd take with you?
Don't bring everything, because it's hard to get out of Baghdad, and the best thing you can bring with you is like your memories. So you brought with us videotapes.
This hour, we'll share memories with Iraqi refugees in Detroit. And we'll follow a man to a concert.
They were having this rock festival north of Toronto in Ontario, Strawberry Fields. And I took off without a ticket and started hitchhiking. And people would yell, "Get a job, get a haircut."
And a moment he'll never forget on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in the Twin Cities. On this first weekend in spring, we're revisiting some of our favorite stories of the past few months, like when we talked to the esteemed cellist Yo-Yo Ma about his Silk Road project. Later this hour, he describes how the trade route between Europe and Asia affected both music and culture. This weekend, he's in Nashville, Tennessee, working on a new cross-cultural project. How about you? What are you up to?
This weekend, I have so many things to do. I can't believe it. I have to go to a Bible class. I have to go to a lecture.
I'm probably going to go to a friend's house or go to a movie.
My niece is coming down from Boston, and she's staying for a couple of days, and we're going out to Long Island.
I have two birthday parties to go to, one for a 6-year-old and one for a 26-year-old.
This weekend, I'm waiting for the baby to come. I'm 39 weeks pregnant.
This weekend, I am going to be helping my mom shoveling mulch.
Children of America, I hope you are hearing that.
Especially my children. Those voices come from Brooklyn, San Francisco, and Las Vegas.
This is the radio show about what Americans are doing this weekend, and one thing some of us are doing is readjusting. Members of the New Mexico Army National Guard came home from Iraq this month, along with other U.S. troops, and although they might be glad to be back, there is always the risk that some of them may have come home too fast. Army researchers say soldiers returning from the Middle East often don't have time to absorb the trauma of what they've been through. Back in World War II, soldiers would be put on the so-called slow boat home. That was the only way you could transport all those troops. But it also had the effect of giving them time to reflect, talk about their experiences, and to decompress. Today, you could be on the streets of Iraq dodging IEDs one week and walking the aisles of Walmart the next. Reporter Nancy Mullane is in Northern California, and she has our story.
It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon at the Concord Senior Center. Colorful military medals, unit patches, and American flags fill the multipurpose room. The East Bay Veterans Fair and vets of the past have come to help the newest of their group transition from being at war to being a civilian. So far, more than 1 million troops have been sent to fight the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Army studies have found at least 30% of those coming home suffer from depression, anxiety, or post-traumatic stress disorder. And the Government Accountability Office says there are some 200,000 homeless veterans from current and past wars living on American streets.
Hi. I'm so glad to meet somebody in the flesh.
So veterans who've successfully made the transition hold events like this one. In one room, employers from local businesses hand out business cards, while in another, larger room, admissions counselors from nearby colleges and universities hold out financial aid applications. Sitting behind UC Berkeley's table, 4 Iraq War vets have come for the day. They're offered up as models of soldiers turned students. But to hear them tell it, the transition wasn't easy. Jason's the most outspoken of the small group. He was in the Army for 10 years. The last one was spent in Iraq.
Things had wrapped up. We went to King Fahad Air Base and got on a plane. I think it was actually a Delta Airlines plane with stewardesses and everything. And we were full of sand and armed.
Almost immediately after the plane landed at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, Jason says he had one thing in mind, to wash away the dirt and the sand that he says was everywhere, in his eyelids and up his nose.
I got off the plane, I went home, I took a metal folding chair and an icy six-pack of beer, and I got in the shower, turned the shower on real hot, got my metal folding chair out, unfolded it under the shower, and sat there under the hot-ass shower and drank the whole six-pack. And then I got dressed, and I went off post and got a great meal. And then I came back, and I crawled into my bed, and I went to sleep.
But after the initial relief, Jason says he woke up to a harsher reality. He realized it wasn't going to be so easy to wash off the fact that he'd been fighting for his life in Iraq, that he couldn't just change back to being a civilian. He was deeply troubled, ready to hit anyone over a small misunderstanding.
The expectation that you can move from one set of norms to this, the military set of norms to the civilian set of norms, and function appropriately, that expectation, I think, is... it's absurd.
Veterans who have been in a fight and who go from a fight to their civilian home or to the streets of their civilian town in just a couple days feel like they've been dropped in from Mars.
Jonathan Shea is a psychologist at the Department of Veterans Affairs Outpatient Clinic in Boston.
You have adapted both in mind and in the physiology of your body to the real situation of other people trying to kill you and often doing a doggone good job of it. I mean, you see your friends die or get maimed.
Shea says there's a giant chasm between the returning combat soldier and the people waiting back at home. For instance, take a soldier's adaptation to driving on a highway in Iraq.
Number one, you drive as fast as you can. Number two, you try and stay equidistant from the two sides of the road. You bring that back home, and you have an automatic setup for numerous moving traffic violations when you're driving your own car if you flip into that surviving in Iraq mode.
Jason says he tried to tell his family and friends what he'd been through and what he'd done in Iraq and why he was the person he'd become, but that didn't work.
Everybody who's in the Army has the first time they will tell, you know, what's a good story you have from the service, right? And you mention a little something that you saw or did or something like that. You realize immediately never to do that again. That's the one mistake you never make again, because that's the firsthand experience. Nobody wants that. But at least be conscious of the fact that people had that experience. Be aware of it.
A short walk down just about any shopping street in America, there isn't much awareness of war. Posters announce holiday sales and bell-ringing Santas raise money for people struggling economically. But the war, not so much. But there are people and organizations gearing up to help transitioning vets find their way.
It was like the saying of Hillel. I don't know if you know the Jewish philosopher, if not now, when? If not me, then who?
Joseph Bobrow is a clinical psychologist and founder of the Coming Home Project. It's a nonprofit group of veterans, psychotherapists, and interfaith leaders who provide day-long and weekend retreats for returning vets and their families. There, the team of professionals offer treatment and psychological trauma, and they provide the vet with tools for stress management.
We try to create the conditions for healing. And those conditions are safety, trust, a sense of unconditional acceptance.
Meanwhile, deep in the Northern California Redwoods, another group is taking their support of returning vets to another level. They're building a veterans' village, a four-story dormitory-style building that, beginning in January, will house up to 18 veterans from the Iraq War.
This is going to be a gym. Plus a sauna. Somebody talk about a sauna, so we'll have that. And it's not just relaxing and good, but it's also to eliminate toxins and keep healthy.
When the building's finished, the veterans living there will get long-term counseling, help finding jobs and applying to colleges. But most importantly, this village offers vets who have just gotten back from combat a chance to sit quietly under towering redwoods with other vets who understand where they've been and what they've been through. Mark Nipper will manage the project. As a Vietnam veteran, he served in the Navy on a nuclear submarine, and now he says this is the least he can do.
We were at war every time we went to sea, and I really thought I was going to die. And I'm older now, and I need to have some legacy to leave behind. And what better way than to help the folks coming home now and welcome them home? I didn't get welcome home till 30 years after I served.
But even with efforts by individuals and organizations to help returning vets transition, psychologist Jonathan Shea says something critical is missing. Shea says throughout history, from the ancient Greeks to the Roman legions, societies held communal rites of purification when their soldiers returned from battle, a ritual in which the society accepted responsibility for what the fighters had been asked to do in their name.
We really need to pay attention to the health of our democracy. And this is part of the invisible substructure of democracy, is how veterans are returned to civilian society and how well their further flourishing is nourished or destroyed.
Back at the Concord Veterans Fair, Jason says the American people sent the troops to war, and now it's their responsibility to bring them back and help them heal.
It's the civilians, it's the society at large who bears the responsibility, not just the ethical obligation, but the moral obligation as well, to take the people who have served in this capacity that their government has mandated that they serve, and then transition them back to being a civilian.
In San Francisco, I'm Nancy Mullane for Weekend America.
Nancy mentioned an organization called the Coming Home Project. The project holds group therapy sessions for troops and their families. A recent newsletter recounts a session in Oakland that begins with a soldier saying he doesn't mind having media there as long as they don't ask him whether he killed someone in Iraq. It continues through the troops and families telling their stories, also resisting telling their stories. And they describe the whole process as being this enormous container of unconditional love. And that container is big enough to hold all of the grief, the anger, the powerlessness, and the damage. It's important that there's something bigger than all of that.
Yeah, 5 years into the war, we're really getting a bigger feel of the kind of emotional support that these troops need when they return back from the front. And the project is actually asking for more volunteers, psychotherapists who live in the Bay Area, who can get the training and really help with this project. I can't imagine it. The demand must be extraordinary for that kind of counseling.
You can learn more about the Coming Home Project and find out how to volunteer through our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
One Detroit family that fled the war in Iraq doesn't have to imagine happier times. They can relive them anytime they want by putting a tape in the VCR. coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, thanks for sharing your weekend with us. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke.
I'm from Burma.
I came from Iraq.
I'm from Somalia.
I'm from Somalia too.
I go to America.
We have carried with us
videotapes,
my dad's picture,
some very old Sunday school books.
Without your past, you're nothing.
Over the past year, we've been bringing you a series called One Thing. The series is about recently arrived refugees and the one thing they brought with them to the United States. Last year, 41,000 refugees were allowed into this country, and out of that number, only 202 were from Iraq. Today we meet three of them, the Augustine family from Baghdad. They now live in Detroit. The Augustines are Christians, their mother is Chaldean, the father is Latin Catholic. Their son, Arkan, is a pre-med student at a community college, and he's also been working part-time at a grocery store in Detroit. That's a job he didn't have to do in his old life back in Iraq. What's the one thing that the Augustines chose to bring with them? Home videos.
Just one second. Oh, yeah. My dad has videotaped us for all my entire life.
I remember this.
Every time we watch it, it's very, very, very nice feeling to remember your childhood.
It's because of this dance. You can look at it, please. Very nice.
Yeah, you can remember how it was at first. Because without your past, you're nothing.
This is my birthday.
Back home, we had like best life back there.
In Iraq, it was a really good, good life.
But now, Iraq, it's like hell. You don't know where, what time you're gonna die. Every second, you're in danger. First, when like the American army got in Iraq, we thought everything gonna be real good. We were happy, but nothing happened. My dad, he became the head of the Christians. He was like the relationship between the Christians in Iraq and the government.
In my office, very danger. The street danger, the church danger, in my house danger. Everything in Iraq is danger, really.
So after we got like a couple messages, either you pay us this amount of money or your house get bombed, we had to leave Iraq. We left just about 2 days, like everything.
You leave Iraq and it is very danger.
The road was like thieves, whatever, all around. Actually, we couldn't bring everything because it's hard to get out of Baghdad, and best thing you can bring with you is like your memories. So we brought with us videotapes.
You should see this.
This is like the last day in my summer school. Isn't it good to bring your memories with you? Yeah. Life in Jordan, if you have money, you live like a king. If you don't, there is no future in Jordan. You can't work, you can't do anything. We stayed like 6-7 months in Jordan, and the day I find out that we're gonna get here to the United States, I was playing basketball with my friend in Jordan. I was like, wow! But I couldn't say it out loud. I didn't tell him until like last week before I leave. My aunt lives in Detroit. All my mom's relatives, they live in Detroit.
I want to see my sister here.
My mom's, she did all the work for us. Yeah, all papers.
This visa is very difficult to get.
We're lucky we got here like in 1 year. No more than that. I know a couple families, they've been waiting there for like 5-6 years, even 11 years, and they're still there.
This is our church in Iraq. It's a very big church in Iraq.
My mom is Chaldean, and the rest of us are Latin Catholic. We are Christians from Iraq. Oh, here's the when the cardinal, when he visits Iraq. Here's me and my sister waiting for him. I'm holding the Iraqi flag, and my sister holding the Vatican flag. When we got here, wow. It's just Chaldeans everywhere you go.
Here
are my friends, right here. Here is Simon.
We have Chaldean Arabic malls and Chaldean Arabic radio stations.
Newspapers, yellow pages. There is even Chaldean men running for mayor in our town. Chaldeans everywhere you go in Detroit, Michigan. We're like, are we in Iraq or something?
My job? Oh, I work in Papa Joe's. It's grocery store, yeah. I work in produce.
Something we have to do at night, that's push carts inside.
I didn't have to work in Iraq. We were like high-class family. We lived in a very good neighborhood. I used to like just take money from my dad and spend it everywhere. Now it's different.
Me, my sister, we gotta work. I have to. My dad sits there, his remote in his hand, news, all the time news, but now I don't really watch news anymore, just hurting me, news hurting me. Like before there was one Saddam, now we have like 100 Saddams. Why the United States and Iraq? Do they want what happened now, or they can't control it? I don't know. If the people ask me if you want to go back home and live there, no, not really. I like it here, because here you can get whatever you want. By your studying, you're working hard, you'll get it for sure. Yeah.
My dad's still videotaping us, even today, in every occasion, like birthdays, graduation.
This is in Detroit. It's my graduation. It's on June 9th, 2007. All right.
Just 1 second.
Now let's go to the party. Now we're cutting cake. So we keep videotaping everything.
Even regular days sometimes. If we have nothing to do, we go videotape everything.
Everything.
The story was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler.
In late February, a Chaldean Catholic archbishop was kidnapped in Mosul, Iraq. His kidnapping has called attention to the Chaldean Christian minority that lives in the mostly Muslim country.
Yeah, most people don't know that Chaldeans have lived in Iraq for thousands of years. They were actually converted to Christianity by St. Thomas. And many started relocating to the Detroit metro area when a lot of immigrants started coming in the 1900s to work in the car industry. And now there are about 100,000 Chaldeans in the area. And Archon was right when he said in the story, it seems like he was already back in Iraq by being in Detroit. Because if you ever visit, you will notice the impact of their culture on the life of the city, from the food, commerce, worship, everything. You're listening to Weekend America.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Coming up, cellist Yo-Yo Ma spends time with us off the Silk Road. On Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Now that spring has sprung, you might find yourself in more social situations on the weekend, and that might require small talk. Small talk can be tough even for United States presidents. President Bush famously chit-chatted into an open mic at the G8 conference in 2006. Aside from lamenting that he really wanted to go home, he also blasted the United Nations, and he cursed. Not a good day. No. Small talk can go really bad, even when you're not the president. This is one of our favorite stories by Charlie Schroeder, who went to his friend's wedding in Mexico. And at the wedding, he started to impersonate the fake journalist from Kazakhstan, Borat. Here's Charlie with the groom, Jay Rees.
We arrived in Mexico in the middle of the afternoon, and it was the Puerto Vallarta airport. And Jay, who was hosting the wedding, was there. So I remember sort of greeting him. I think the very first thing that I said to him was, "Happy times! You know, it's your wedding. It's very nice." You know, foot hit the tarmac, and I was Borat.
Yekshimash! My name is Borat. This is my country of Kazakhstan.
I was possessed.
I don't remember the first time. I actually do, but I remember it, like, starting very early. I wish we knew, like, the opening date of the movie. It was probably, like, 3 weeks before, I would say. Like, it had already kind of caught on, and everybody was already doing Borat. So when Charlie was doing it, I was like, seriously, you're going to do Borat?
Well, I mean, the thing about the wedding is that my wife and I knew Jay and Rebecca, the bride and groom, but we didn't really know that many other people. And when I'm in a situation like that, I go into entertainer guy mode. You know, I didn't even realize how much it was getting out of control because there was another guy there from New York. Like, the two of us would sort of encourage each other. I'd be like, "Hello, how you doing?" And he'd be like, "Very nice." And then we'd be like, "I'm good." And he'd be like, "I'm good." You know, and it became sort of like we would feed off of one another.
I think what Charlie told me later is that he thought he was killing the whole weekend and that people were loving him. And we were all just like rolling our eyes, hoping it would go away.
I would say that in my waking hours, I was using the voice with strangers a good 50% of the time and not even aware of it. I mean, literally not aware that that's how often I was using it. Oh, my God. We had a Thanksgiving meal while we were there at the wedding. And, you know, they brought around that turkey. He's like, I like dark meat. I was like, I like green beans. Very nice.
You know, anything was like, anybody want to go surfing?
Good to see you. It's nice to see you.
I do remember that. After the wedding, everyone was saying, like, congratulations, congratulations. And Charlie was like, high five. Hey.
I didn't have any idea that my Borat imitation was causing the kind of reaction that it was until about a month later when Jay and I were playing golf. He just kind of turned to me. He was like, "Charles, why were you being such a tool at my wedding?"
Somehow the Borat thing came up, and I told Charlie that, you know, he was a bit of a tool.
And I didn't know what to think. All this time, I thought that I was Mr. Entertainer, you know? When Jay said to me, you know, why was I being such a tool doing Borat? I mean, I immediately stopped doing it. Every time I started doing it, I bit my lip. And really just, in fact, since then, I haven't really done any impersonations at all. Borat, he will not be coming out at all. Maybe a little, just once, but that's it, just to get a laugh.
Charlie Schroeder and Jay Rees live in Los Angeles. The actor who plays Borat, Sacha Baron Cohen, says that he's permanently retiring that character. And I'm sure Jay hopes that Charlie will soon follow suit.
Mm-hmm.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
We're capturing the American weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and this weekend in Nashville, Tennessee, the amazing multifarious classical cellist Yo-Yo Ma is recording with bluegrass and country star Alison Krauss. And to anyone surprised at his mixing of styles, Ma says, quote, "The notion of cultural purity is a dead end." Now, when he made that statement, he was talking specifically about his Silk Road project. For the last 9 years, Ma has been exploring the cultural and musical exchange that's happened across Asia and Eastern Europe, thanks to hundreds of years of exploration and trade. Along with the peaceful trade, empires and explorers have also brought war to that continent. And with that in mind, we invited Yo-Yo Ma to narrate a piece of music from his latest Silk Road album. Welcome to Weekend America.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. I'm so happy to be part of your show.
First, we want to hear a bit of a song, a piece from the album called Silent City.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think you've just picked probably the most serious piece of music on this album because it is Kahan Kalhor's way of trying to describe a tragedy that took place in a city in Kurdistan in northern Iraq. The city of Halabja was destroyed. You know, it's really hard to tell that kind of story in music because sometimes you can overdo it. But I think he found a brilliant solution, which is that he actually tells the story. We hear this music as if we were watching a film in reverse. So it starts as if from nothing, from devastation, and then it gradually builds back to life. Hear an incredibly haunting Sufi melody, and then it ends with a Sufi dance, which is, and Sufi music is the kind you know about the what do you call them, the whirling dervishes. It's a part of Islam that believes very much in transcendence, and it leads us to, in the storytelling, by having this kind of scenario, it makes us feel that there's the possibility of rebirth. This whole section is kind of improvised, so each time it's very different. And this section, basically, we are picking notes, and just when we feel the moment is right, it's like a Quaker meeting. You know, you move and you play a note when the spirit moves you. And then Kahan, who plays this incredibly gorgeous Persian instrument, the kemanche, he starts a kind of a little riff, a rhythm, and then we start to kind of improvise on that. And gradually it builds to a huge crescendo, and we end sort of like a tumbling of notes coming to just one point that's totally still, and that's when that melody comes in, which is incredibly haunting. You know, it's almost like that's the essential of life.
We've been listening there to the Silent City music inspired by the destruction of a town in Iraqi Kurdistan. This is a reminder that the Silk Road, of course, wasn't just about trade and cultural exchange. It was about invasion and violence and destruction.
But it's also about, in terms of trade, I think one of the things that I find myself always trying to think about, but I'm challenged by it, is how can I, with even with all the traveling that I've done over many decades, is sort of how can I think of the world as one unit? And I think in certainly in my education, you know, we learn history separately, different countries, different areas, Europe, Americas, and somehow, but yet in looking at the way people have migrated and moved and how ideas have been borrowed, taken over, rethought through, and reinvented, I think that the actual reality is there's been this constant flow over and over and over again, and this is the part we want to celebrate, over the destruction of monuments and civilizations.
I read a story a few months ago, you may have seen this too. Yo-Yo Ma says the notion of cultural purity is a dead end. Quote I read was that nothing great was ever produced in isolation. And here, so this idea of the world being one unit, as you say, this is a very rich but also barbed idea right now. And I wondered, until we become a little more peaceful, should we have more cultural isolation?
My question is, how do we think about the world as one? How do we think of our ever-changing communities? In each one of our communities, do we have a way of dealing with a lot of differences in schools, in the workplace, and in our baseball games? What, you know, what do we need to know about each other and to love about each other to actually form a better basis of communication? And sometimes it's just a time element. People think about time in very different ways. For you and me, it's possibly how busy your day was and, oh my gosh, what do you have to do next week? But for some other people, it's 500 years or 1,000 years is nothing. It was as if this were yesterday. And not to know that means that you're probably going to step on it and step right into it really quickly. And I think those are the types of things that in our ever sort of globalized world, unless we can actually know these things, you know, isolation is only going to make things worse because we're not isolated.
When you're thinking about how vastly differently we view, let's say, time, is there a moment musically on this record that is an illustration of that?
We go from Silent City, which is we talked about, where time actually is both front and back, to Ambush from Ten Sides, a story of a battle that actually took place over 2,000 years ago. It was not just a battle. It was an epic battle that ushered in the beginning of a dynasty, in this case, the Han Dynasty.
Stands out to you the most when you look back on working with so many different people?
What I love, actually, is the way that pieces come together in as many different ways as there are people, because sometimes it's an idea, sometimes it is one person generating and then other people taking it on. I think Vocation is a spontaneous generation piece. You know, it was made under no pressure, and except for the fact that five people really, really love being together, and they make something.
Five people who speak how many different languages, by the way?
Well, let's see. Don Juan speaks Korean. Sandeep speaks English and Hindi. Mark Suter speaks German. Joe Gramley speaks Italian. Shane Shanahan speaks a little Turkish. Mm-hmm. A good Irish boy, you know.
Uh-huh.
Which nice Irish lad doesn't speak a little Turkish, you know?
Of course.
I think what's so exciting for people is that when you see somebody else doing something that you know a lot about, but they do it in such a different way that you're dying to find out much more. They know things deeply, but then when they see somebody else do something with such incredible depth and virtuosity, they're dying to find out what the other person knows. And then you have this electricity that goes along where, and that's this creative spirit that I'm talking about, is that they've got nothing to lose by saying, I know nothing about how, you know, what you're doing and how great it is. And they start trading information, learning from one another. And at the end of the day, each one is better as a musician, is richer as a musician from that exchange. And the byproduct is that you get a piece like Vocation.
Yo-Yo Ma, it's been a pleasure spending time with you. Thank you.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye, Bill.
I mentioned earlier that Yo-Yo Ma is in Nashville this weekend playing with bluegrass and country singer and fiddle player Alison Krauss. They're recording the traditional Irish Christmas tune, The Wexford Carol, which will appear on the holiday album that Ma is releasing later this year. You're listening to Weekend America.
For most of us, the weekend means one thing, relaxing.
Yeah, right, and running errands and ferrying the kids around and doing chores and taking care of all the business of running a household.
Right, the weekend, time to relax.
Next weekend, we're kicking off a new series called The Weekend Shift, and it's about all of those important, not relaxing things that end up taking up so much of your weekend, and we want to hear from you.
What's your story about working the weekend shift? Are you one of the people that work all weekend long to make the other people's weekends possible? Or maybe your weekend is just filled with volunteering, helping others, and doing good.
Do you have a weekend project that's taken over your life? A monster in your garage that's your ticket to never working again, perhaps? Tell us your story. Go to weekendamerica.org and click on The Weekend Shift. Tell us what you do,
why you do it,
and why it's worth your weekend. It's at weekendamerica.org. A Ferris wheel, a groovy tune, the girl of your dreams. Oh, and 50,000 hippies coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper.
The one song that I remember from my childhood.
The first song that I remember.
My dad used to sing it.
The most important song.
I just love to play it over and over and over.
For this, our final installment of Song and Memory, we went back to 1970 with listener Harley Hansen. Harley was a college freshman when campuses were erupting in protests, but what he remembers was a certain rock festival, a certain ride, and one of the most luminous songs of the period, Let's Get Together by the Youngbloods.
My name's Harley Hansen, live in Sacramento, California, and in 1970, I was kind of at that stage that's euphemistically called finding yourself. I knew what I didn't want to do was join the Army and go into the Vietnam War. I did not know what I wanted to do. Consequently, I was going to school.
I am sick of the racist war in Vietnam when we don't have justice in the United
and
States.
When my first year of school ended, I did not want to go home to my parents because they were not fond of long hair. So I went out to Peterborough, New Hampshire, where my sister Karen and my brother-in-law Andrew lived, and I stayed with them. They were very nice to put me up over the summer. When I was up there and I heard that they were having this rock festival north of Toronto in Ontario, Strawberry Fields, and I took off without a ticket and started hitchhiking, and people would yell, "Get a job, get a haircut." They were not fond of seeing people hitchhiking with backpacks and long hair. I was at a rest stop and I saw a group of three cars, New Hampshire license plate. Oh, they looked familiar. And I walked up and said, "Hey, are you from Peterborough?"
"Hey, man, how you doing?"
You know, we determined we were both going the same place. So there I was. I had a ride directly to the rock festival with these guys. One of the people in the car was a kind of pretty girl. Have you seen the sunlight pouring through her hair? She had long, dark hair and dressed in the typical uniform of the day with the blue jeans, the beads, and the little John Lennon shades. You know, and of course, I'm 19 and, you know, basically attracted to anything that moves. We got as far as Buffalo, proceeded to cross the Peace Bridge there, and the Canadian authorities were not overly impressed with, you know, three carloads of hippies, and they kind of grilled us, "How much money do you have? Where are you going?" We told them we were going to the Rock Festival up in Ontario. "Well, the Rock Festival doesn't start till tomorrow." Okay, so back across the bridge, and when we got back to the south end of the bridge, "Oh, welcome to the United States. Unroll your sleeping bag. Put all your contents of your pockets on this table." They searched us thoroughly, asked me for ID, said, "Where's your draft card?"
"Do you know of any reason why you might not qualify for military service?"
"No, I don't have any reasons."
"Okay." I didn't have my draft card on me since it had been destroyed in a very unfortunate small fire earlier, and I'm sure they suspected I was evading the draft. Finally, they let me go, and there were 300 or 400 hippies out there waiting to get across the bridge. They'd all been turned back just as we had. The next day, the rock festival started. Grand Funk Railroad was there, and Canned Heat, and Sha Na Na, and the Youngbloods. And anyway, I was wandering around the festival site with this pretty girl, and we noticed that there was a carnival up on this little hill kind of at the back of the concert site, and we decided for some reason we wanted to ride the Ferris wheel. So we get on the Ferris wheel, and it just happened to stop right on top, and we're pretty much in the catbird seat overlooking this whole grounds of 50,000 people, and the Youngbloods at that second happened to launch into "Let's Get Together." Come on, people now. And so I kind of look over at this beautiful woman thinking, maybe I should try to kiss her. And then I thought, no, I'll make a fool of myself. And then, of course, the Ferris wheel started up. The song ended, and we wandered back to our group and enjoyed the rest of the three-day rock and roll event. I saw her a time or two after that around town, but then that was it. And I always wondered over the years, you know, what happened to this person? Love is but a song we sing. Fears we would die. Of course, now to this day, when I hear the Youngbloods play "Let's Get Together," I close my eyes. You can make the mountains ring, or make the angels cry. And I can feel the sun on my face, and I'm back, a 19-year-old in 1970, on top of a Ferris wheel, stopped, overlooking the grounds of 50,000 hippies, and the Youngbloods are on stage playing that song. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together, try to love one another right now. So anybody from Peterborough, New Hampshire, who went to the Strawberry Fields Festival in late July or early August of 1970, if you were in a group of three cars, one of which was a Mustang, and you rode the Ferris wheel while the Youngbloods were playing, you need to get in touch with them.
Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together.
Harley, please tell us if she contacts you. Harley Hansen from Sacramento. Our Song and Memory series is produced by Ann Hepperman, Kara Oler, and Rick Moody, with production help from Lila Dobbs. And you can watch a video of the very Strawberry Fields concert that Harley went to in 1970, and look into all the other stories from our series, Song and Memory, at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Well, this is the first weekend of spring, and we wanted to celebrate by venturing into our virtual backyard and chatting with you over the fence.
Yes, since last summer, we've been exploring the seasons through your memories.
So it's time for you to share your springtime memories with us. What was your most memorable spring break? Does life shift for you in the springtime? If so, tell us how. How do you know that spring has even arrived in your part of the country? However you observe the coming of spring, just let us be a part of it. Share your stories of the new season, your memories, your family rituals. Meet us at our website at weekendamerica.org.
That's it for this hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Thanks for spending it with us. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Desiree Cooper. And while you're sharing your springtime stories with us, remember you can download a free enhanced podcast of the entire program at weekendamerica.org. If you celebrate it, happy Easter. Get out there and enjoy your weekend.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
When Sam went to college, he chose a religious school, but his religion was a little different.
As soon as that powder went up my nose, it was just like, you know, this is what God wanted for me. It was just like all I had to do was take cocaine, and I could feel good about myself.
On the next Weekend America, how one man's choice of college was the only thing that saved him. Join us.